Well, so let's start here in Isaiah 2, and we'll begin in verse 1, and let's go ahead and read through verse 4. We'll kind of get the bird's eye view of this text, and then we'll kind of zero in and look at some of the details here and make some applications. I think actually in this lesson, I think the discussion questions are the best in this lesson of all the lessons that we've talked about. So I think we're going to have some really good stimulating questions to ask tonight too. Let's begin in Isaiah 2 and verse 1. The word which Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Now it will come about that in the last days the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains and will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he will judge between the nations, and will render decisions for many peoples. And they will hammer their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn war. That's a pretty happy prospect, isn't it? That nations will never again learn war. We're going to talk about what that means here this evening. Let's start here. It will come about that in the last days, he says. Let's kind of have a frame of reference here, okay? And I'm not asking for which the one this is, but what are some different ways that the term last days or end of days, those kinds of terms, what are some ways that those terms can be used? What are some different contexts or time frames?
The end of the old law.
Well, we got two different ones right there off the bat. End of time. I mean, just kind of the idea of the end of all things, things coming to a completion, the culmination of human activity on planet Earth, and the end of the world. Pretty simple. I'd say that's a use of it. End of the old law. I think that's a good way of looking at it also. End of the old law. Seeing the last days not as like a specific set sort of time, but more like an era. You know, not like a specific set of days, like from this day to this day, but more like a period of time that results in a change somehow. A change of law, a change of understanding. Last days in the New Testament are sometimes used to refer to the end of Jerusalem in the first century, the days preceding the destruction of Jerusalem, that those were the last days, you know, in parentheses, you know, kind of by inference, those were the last days of Jerusalem, or the last days of the existence of the temple there on the Temple Mount, or the last days, like Dennis said, the last days of the law. So there's different ways that this can be used. And yet here in Isaiah chapter 2, I think we have a pretty clear picture of which last days we're talking about. I guess when we look at this, I don't think we need to be wishy-washy and be like, well, you know, Isaiah 2 could be talking about this or could be talking about that. I think even though last days tends to be a term that has some mystery attached to it, in Isaiah 2, there is not any mystery when it comes to the last days. And the reason why I say that is because of a couple of scriptures here. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 17, what are the last days according to Acts chapter 2 verse 17? Yeah, well, yeah, but specifically I would say Peter was in them in Acts chapter 2. Yeah, but you're right, Dennis, we're in them. Peter was in the last days because he's quoting from some scriptures, Joel, for example. Joel is one of the big scriptures he quotes from there in Acts chapter 2, Joel chapter 2. And he's saying, this is now. I mean, all this talk in the book of Joel in chapter 2, all this talk of people prophesying, and all this talk of things changing, and all this talk of cataclysmic events in Joel chapter 2, verses 28 and 30, through 32, he's saying, this is it. I mean, this is the time. These are the last days described here in Joel chapter 2. These are the last days. I would also say Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 2, the writer of Hebrews notes in Hebrews 1 verse 2 that he was living in the last days. So even though there is, again, some mystery attached to that term, you know, for the most part, when we're talking about last days, we're talking about first century events. whether, again, it's the destruction of Jerusalem or the end of the old law or the coming of the Messiah, the last days. And besides, when you read Isaiah chapter 2, can you really, is there any other direction you can take but Messiah with Isaiah chapter 2? There really isn't. When you read Isaiah 2, 2 through 4, you're going like, well, that's talking about the Messiah. Yeah, there's not another direction you can go with that. And when did the Messiah come? But the first century. So the reason I bring this up is just so that we have kind of a frame of reference, that is time frame here of what are we talking about? When is this happening? Is Christ glorified now? Is Christ the chief mountain raised above the hills now as we're talking? Yeah. One way that I would look at the term last days is a little bit of what Dennis was alluding to earlier, is more of a period, that we are in the last days. If you think about kind of the first days, the book of Genesis, and I know the Bible never calls them that by name. The Bible never says that Genesis was the first days, so to speak. But if you look at that as the patriarchal period, those were kind of the first days. The next days, the next period, would have been under the old law. And what, according to our understanding of these dispensations, what is the last phase of religious revelation? Yeah, the Christian dispensation. The law of Christ, grace under Christ, the gospel. The gospel is the last dispensation of religious revelation, where God revealed Himself. We've seen this before in previous lessons, but God revealed Himself to Abraham and to the patriarchs under that period. And then God revealed Himself in the law and revealed Himself on Mount Sinai and gave that covenant, that new covenant with His people. And according to Jeremiah chapter 31, there will come a time when a final covenant will come, a new covenant that will replace the law. Hebrews chapter 8 goes on and quotes Jeremiah 31 and refers to that idea of that old law being replaced by this new one, an old covenant, new covenant. Now we're living under that new covenant. We're in the last days. And I think that refers to the last period of religious revelation, that we're in the Christian age. Understand, of course, that the Hebrew word for days is yom, and it's a word that can refer to more than just one 24-hour period. It can refer to a 24-hour day, but it can also just refer to the daytime. Not a full 24 hours, but 12 hours of daylight. It can also refer to a long period of time, in the days of David, or in the day of the Lord, or in the day of Christ. I mean, there's a different way that you can see the word day, and I think when we're talking about in the last days, maybe that's one way that we can understand it. Any other thoughts there on that idea of in the last days? Anything else you want to add to that? All right. So, in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord. What is fitting about a mountain when describing the Messiah? What do you think of when you think of a mountain? What do you think of?
Majestic.
Majestic. Perfect. What else?
Rock solid.
Rock solid. I like that. Rock solid. Firm foundation. The structure itself. You know, most mountains are loosely conical. I mean, and when you think of what is the strongest structure, it's either a pyramid or a cone. You know, those are the strongest structures imaginable, simply because of the way they're built, they can withstand it. Mountains are loosely conical, so their structure, their foundation, they're firm, they're solid, they're time-tested, weather-worn. They're always there, they'll always be there, in a sense. I understand that erosion, we're not talking about specific things like that. Erosion does affect mountains in a certain way. But as far as human interaction with mountains go, and as far as like from our relative lifespans, mountains are essentially the oldest things on planet Earth, is one way to look at it. Brian?
They're visible from far away, from long distances, so they're sort of an icon or a landmark, I guess.
Beacon, yeah, they almost serve as like a beacon. You know where you are in the valley in relation to Camelback, don't you? You can pretty much see Camelback from almost anywhere. I mean, not everywhere, but almost anywhere. I can see Camelback from the freeway overpass out at Val Vista in Gilbert, okay? I can see Camelback all the way from there. So if you can see Camelback, you know, oh, okay, I know how to get to Central Phoenix. The same goes with the Santan Mountain Range. When we're on our way home from church, we always know how far are we from home, because you can see the Santan Mountains out in the distance past Queen Creek. you can always see those mountains. They serve as those guideposts, those points. Portland, Oregon is a perfect example. You can see Mount Hood from everywhere in Portland, Oregon. It's always there on the horizon somewhere. And you kind of know, where are you in relation to Mount Hood? So I like that. It's a beacon. It's a pointer, a guidepost of sorts. Yeah, Mitch.
Militarily, mountains, the high ground is always a position of strength.
Yeah, and that's a good point also. Militarily, the high ground is always the position of strength. There is, if you can get the high ground, you have gained an advantage over your adversaries. So it's interesting, and I know it wouldn't fit, obviously, it's a ridiculous thing to say, but it's fitting that Jesus is not the valley of the house of the Lord. It's fitting that Jesus is not the, he's not the outcropping of the house of the Lord. He's not the peninsula of the house of the Lord. He's not the bay or the inlet of the house of the Lord. I mean, he's the mountain. He's the mountain. He's the high ground. There's nothing that rises or towers over him because, as the text clearly says, this is a mountain that has risen up over the hills that surround it. It is superior in size and grandeur to those things as well. Go ahead, Dale.
In Revelation, when we looked at the seashore where the beast came out of and mm-hmm. kind of the society all grouped around in a certain area, when we looked at God and his people, they were up on a mountain. They were well above all of society.
That's
and the difficulties that come with society in general, maybe the bad, complete bad influences from the rest of the world, they're above that. They're beyond that. They're isolated from it.
Yeah, there is a sense of being exalted above things. That Jesus, and I like this, that if the Messiah is the mountain of the house of the Lord, he's a part of the world, in a sense. He's connected to it, but exalted above it. And I think that's very fitting, then, that the Son of Man would be connected to the world by his human existence, that he walked the face of this earth. He ate food and communicated with people face to face. He had a human body, that could sweat, a human body that could cry, a human body that could bleed, and a human body that could die. Ooh, that kind of rhymed. It was really poetic. I like that. Somebody write that down. That's going to be a song someday. It's recorded. That's right. But it was a human body, so he was connected, and yet, like Colossians 2 verse 9 says, he was the fullness of deity dwelling in bodily form. So, human, yes, connected to the earth, but risen above it. And mountains are connected. Mountains don't float, okay, above the earth. They are connected to it, very much connected to the earth, but still risen above it. Donna's got a comment up here also.
I can't help but think about Sinai and the law of Moses coming on the mountain,
yeah.
and then the fear and terror that the people had about even approaching the mountain, and
yeah.
then also the mountain, like in the Transfiguration, that the mount, all those mountains have a commonality.
Yeah, and let's jump on board with that, as if we don't have enough to talk about tonight, right? But that's actually good. The symbolism of the mountain is something that does appear throughout Scripture. You see the symbolism of the mountain. Where did the ark rest? On the top of a mountain, okay? Where did Abraham go to sacrifice Isaac? On the top of a mountain. Where did Elijah go when he wanted to present a challenge to the prophets of Baal in 1 Kings 18? Yeah, top of a mountain. Okay, where did Jesus go to be transfigured? The top of a mountain. Where did the Sermon on the Mount occur? On a mountain. I mean, you see this is a theme that runs throughout the Bible. And then you get to the book of Hebrews, and you mentioned Mount Sinai and the fear that people had about Mount Sinai. And it's interesting that when you get to Hebrews chapter 12, it talks about the mountain here in verse 18 and how Mount Sinai, that we don't come to a mountain that may be touched, to a blazing fire, to darkness and gloom and the whirlwind and the blast of a trump, the sound of words. This was Mount Sinai. It was scary. It was big. It was scary. It was terrifying. Trumpet blasts and lightning bolts. And I mean, it was terrifying. But he said here in verse 22, but you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to myriads of angels. So what's interesting is Mount Sinai, the old law, was a mountain, at a mountain. And Mount Sinai is also used several other places in the New Testament, by the way, to describe the old law. Kind of a symbolic way of, you know, we go to Mount Sinai, or this occurred at Mount Sinai, or Mount Sinai has been done away with. I mean, so the symbolism's there, but Mount Zion, on the other hand, is seen as a very welcoming mountain. This is a place that draws you in. Oh, almost like Isaiah chapter 2 and the streams of the nations pouring or streaming toward it. Oh, it's interesting. All these things are connected, isn't it?
It's the closest place you can get to God.
Yeah.
On top of a mountain, and that's either going to be good or it's going to be bad.
Yeah, well, like, how about the Tower of Babel? What were they trying to do? They were trying to make a man-made mountain, basically, to try and get, you know, reach to heaven in a sense. I like that. That's good. And I love climbing mountains also. Boy, mountains are awesome. They're just, if you... Jesus was tempted on the mountain. That's right. Yeah. He was brought up to a very high place where he could see all of the kingdoms of the world. He was offered those kingdoms as well. Mountains are just, there's something about mountains. Like Dale said, there's something about mountains where it's, in a physical sense, we almost see it as like a symbolic thing where you feel like that's the closest you can get to God. Now, we aren't literally close to God when you're on top of the mountain. That's not what Dale was meaning at all. But there's something about the sense that you get, the emotions, the connection, where you get to the top of a mountain, you feel like you're on top of the world. You're able to commune with God without the clutter and the distractions of the things around you. Right? Lance, and you've been to the top of some pretty tall mountains too, my friend.
We won't talk about that, though. No. Whenever we talk about a courtroom, the judge is supposed to be the highest person. Authority is established. God established this relative position. Whenever his dominion is described, God's dominion is over everything.
Yeah.
So just in our languages, it's described, if you're in a high point, you're in a point of authority. You know, respect. That's the high point. And so it just, we have an understanding that whenever you're talking about, you know, elevation, you know, being higher is better.
Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 21 says that he was raised up far above all rule and authority and power and dominion, raised up above all those things. So, yeah, that's true. Colossians makes the same point also of Jesus being exalted, the one who has dominion over all things, raised above. That's a good point. It says, in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. He will be the chief of the mountains. He'll be raised above all the hills. Let's talk about that here as being the chief, the one who is the highest one. Being the mountain of the house of the Lord, Christ is exalted above all other things. There is no other name by which men are saved but Christ, Acts chapter 4 and verse 12. There's no ruler or authority that stands above our Lord's, Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 21. And I like this, that he's raised above the hills. There is an acknowledgement. Are there other prominent features in this prophetic landscape? Yeah. There's other hills. There are hills there, but who has the highest? Yeah. There are other hills, which I think it's an acknowledgement that there are, you know, there are places of exaltation that men create for themselves. There are rulers and kings, and there are dominions. There are certainly, I think you can see, in some sense, there are demons like Satan who exalt themselves above where their rule is supposed to be. So, sure, there are some other hills. There are other hills, but who rises above all of them? It's the mountain of the house of the Lord. One practical application of this idea of there being other hills around there is sadly, is there a market out there for other religious options? Sure. Yeah, all over the place. There's other hills. You know, it's not, the mountain of the house of the Lord does not rise above a flat plain. That there are other hills that are around it. There are options. If you don't like Jesus, there's plenty of other things you can do. There's other hills you can climb. There's other religions you can partake of. There's other heights you can reach, other religious experiences that you can have. There's earthly rule, earthly authority. You can become president, king. You can be a millionaire or a billionaire. Sure, there's a lot of other options that you can have, but there's only one that rises above all of them. Ryan.
Well, even especially for their society at the time when this was written. I mean, they were dealing with idol worship, so, you know, we have other religious options and things that we can choose to do. I mean, they literally had man-made idols all around them that they could choose from. So this maybe was even more evident for them.
Yeah, and not just idols. I would add to it the plethora of kind of city-state monarchs. You know, this was a time that, aside from some of the biggies, you know, you've got Egypt down south, you've got Assyria up north, and you've got Babylon as kind of a rising star on the international scene. But aside from the biggies, most of this time period, most of the people lived under kind of a feudal system. Small city-states, you know, where cities were basically the kingdoms, and you had each city. Cities were run by their own kings or lords or whatever. And so you had a plethora of earthly authorities and earthly powers in addition to the plethora of gods that they were presented with by the Phoenicians and by the Edomites and the others around them, the Egyptians and the Arabs. There were plenty of other options that existed. Very much like today, just a marketplace, basically. You got your supermarket or your cafeteria buffet of exaltation. That's kind of an interesting term, your cafeteria of exaltation. Patent pending. And all the nations, this is my favorite phrase in this text, by the way. And all the nations will stream to it. What's weird about that? Yeah! Yeah, streams are supposed to go downhill. Streams don't flow toward the mountains, they flow away from the mountains, right? Everybody who knows survival 101 understands that. Brian, if you had gotten lost this last week in your forest wanderings, how would you have found your way out of the woods? You find a stream and you go down. And eventually you're going to run into a freeway or something, right? Yeah, that's just forestry 101. That's just geology 101. That's hydrology. That's nature. That's gravity. Streams flow away from the mountains, not toward them. And yet this mountain has a magnetism to it. There's something about the mountain of the house of the Lord that does not push things away or allow things to slip away. It has a magnetism that draws things in. And nations will stream, not away from it, they'll stream toward it. What a beautiful message that is. It's a beautiful message because it shows that God's mountain is accessible and that it's open and that it's welcoming. You don't have to struggle to get to God's mountain. The stream naturally flows up toward the mountain. We're not like salmon. Okay, we're not like salmon trying to get back upstream so we can lay our eggs 20 miles inland or something, and we're like jumping up waterfalls into, you know, grizzly bears' mouths. We're not struggling to get to the mountain of the house of the Lord. There's a magnetism that naturally attracts things to it, and the streams are flowing up toward it. I love that picture, that image. It's such a rich and layered image of the mountain there. Dennis had a thought over here.
Another thing is you don't really appreciate the size of a mountain from a distance. But as you draw nearer to it, you can see the magnitude of it. And that draws you near. So as we get nearer to Christ, the more that we learn about Christ, the closer we get to that mountain, the more we appreciate the size and the magnitude of Christ.
I can only speak from personal experience. And you know, if you're not a hiker or a mountain climber, you might not understand this or feel this, and that's fine. Everybody has their thrills. Everybody has the things that excite them on planet Earth. But there is something from personal experience. When you see a mountain, and I agree with you, the further away you are, the less interested you are in climbing it. But then as you get closer and closer and closer, there's something about a mountain that does draw you toward it, where you go, I could climb that. I could climb that. And here's what often happens is you underestimate the size of mountains. It's very easy to underestimate because as you draw closer and closer, you're like, oh, that's not that bad. I can do that. But then you actually get on the mountain. You start to climb it and you go, wow, this thing is impressive. And yet, even with that being said, as you're struggling to get up the mountain, is there something about getting to the top that urges you on the further up the mountain you get? Does anybody stop at 99% of the hike and go, it's just too hard for me, I can't make the last 1%? Who turns around 100 feet from the top of a mountain? Nobody turns around when you're 100 feet. There's an urge where you're going, ow, I'm so close, I must get to the top. I don't care how tired I am. I want to get to the top now. And so the closer you get, at least this is my experience, the closer I get to a mountain, the more I'm urged to go up it and get to the top and rise up. And it's the same with God. I don't want to stretch that too far because, again, that's a personal experience of mine. And I can't say that everybody feels the same way about mountains. So that's something that I draw, a conclusion I draw for myself and from my own experience. Dale?
I think the idea that there were a lot of other mountains out there and yet they would stream to his mountain is similar to your comment on Mount Hood.
Yeah.
That no matter, I mean, they're going to draw you as well.
Yeah.
And you're going to be on the way and you'll be drawn in multiple directions. But if you keep your focus on the one that's protruding above all others, you will make it because they're going to try to pull you away.
And sometimes you have to do a lot of weaving between other things to get to God. You have to weave around. You've got to weave around a work schedule, okay? You've got to weave around the needs of your kids and soccer practice and school projects. You have to weave around the temptations that are looking you right in the face, pulling you one way or another. You've got to weave around a lot of hills sometimes to get to that mountain. But let's look at the nations here. Do the nations believe that it's worth it? Do the nations believe that the effort is worth it? Do they believe that the commitment is worth it to get to the mountain? Look at verse 3. And many peoples will come and say, I like this is optimistic. It's optimistic in that, yes, there's work that needs to be done. There's commitment that's required. And yet the prophet is not going like, yep, and it's hard and we'll see how many people come to the mountain. I mean, that's, you know, we'll just see. We'll put it out there and we'll see if anybody wants to come. No, it's many people will come. They will want to come. They'll desire it. They'll yearn for it, long for it. Come, they'll say. Let us go up to the mountain of the house of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways and that we may walk in his paths. That's what they want. Do they believe it's worth it? Yeah. Brian.
I was just going to say that, you know, it seems kind of interesting when you read this today. We might gloss over the fact, but at the time where they were reading this, you know, nations did not come to God very often. And for them to stream to God, you know, that being a very proudly Jewish person reading this, you're probably not very happy about it. I don't know, you know, the pride that the Jews had at some level of their standing before God. But the fact that the nations, and it's basically talking about Gentiles here, are going to come to God and learn of him, and they're going to be excited about it, you know, this sort of fervor and zeal that they're going to have, is probably not, I just wonder what the Jews must have been thinking when they were reading
it. I hadn't thought about that, but that is an interesting question. It does make you wonder how receptive would they have been to the idea of, this is a mountain that's going to rise above others, it will be public, it will be obvious. There's no hiding anymore. You don't get to hide in Jerusalem. You don't get to be your own little clique, your own little clan. But nations are going to come to it. Oh, you know, sometimes we like keeping things just kind of tight-knit and comfortable. It can happen in a congregation, too. We get used to the people around us. We like the people around us. We have a tight-knit group. We act like family, and that's good. I love having a tight-knit congregation, but sometimes congregations can become so tight-knit that there's no room for anyone else to fit in there, you know? Nobody else, they become so tight-knit in their weaving that nobody else can squeeze through the weaving. Nobody else can get in. And I wonder, Brian, like you, I wonder, did the Jews of Isaiah's time period look at this message, and this would have been a tumultuous time period, to say the least. I don't know exactly when Isaiah wrote chapter 2, but Isaiah's prophet, his lifetime as a prophet, covered a great span. From Uzziah, who was a very good king, to Hezekiah, who was also a very good king. But in between, you had some real rotten eggs. You had some really, really Ahaz, for example. Isaiah had a lot of run-ins with Ahaz. Yeah, real run-ins with that guy. This is a tumultuous time period. And do you think the Jews, were they excited at the idea of interlopers coming to the mountain of the house of the Lord? That I don't know. I don't know what the exact answer is, but I think it's worth it to ask it, that maybe this message of, and they'll come, and they'll want to learn, and they'll say, come, let's learn the ways of the Lord. Let's go to him so that he can teach us. And probably Jews are sitting there thinking like, oh, great. Imagine all the work that we're going to have to put in with all these people. We're going to have to teach them about God. No, well, we already know about God. We've known about God for 1,000 years now. Never let the community become so tight-knit that the nations are not allowed to stream to the house, the mountain of the house of the Lord, because we won't let them stream to it. I'll get to you in just a second, Brian, but it reminds me a little bit of like Matthew chapter 23, where Jesus is talking about the Pharisees, and he mentions about proselytizing people. And I want to read that real quick here because it just popped into my head. But it kind of reminds me here in Matthew 23, when he says here verse 15, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you travel about on land and sea to make one proselyte, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves." Go back to verse 13, same idea here. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut off the kingdom of heaven from men, for you do not even enter in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in." And that's kind of what you're saying. So, I don't know. I don't know the exact answer, what they all must have thought about it. I think if you were Isaiah, this is probably a very optimistic and very promising message, but maybe to the broader community, this would have been seen as, boy, we're going to have a lot of strangers around here, a lot of interlopers. You want to add to that?
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say,
your dad had the next comment.
That's kind of the point. Every time you go in the New Testament and you look at Paul talking about the revealing of the mystery of long ago,
yeah,
it's like every time you look throughout the Old Testament, you see these prophecies about the Messiah, and you see the pictures of Christ in the Old Testament, and then along with that, you see a discussion of the nations and, you know, basically talking about the Gentiles. You can see that this is the mystery that was there. It was hidden all throughout the
Ephesians 3.
Right,
all
exactly.
Ephesians 3.
And it's all hidden there in plain sight. So you have to think that they probably just didn't even want to understand what this was talking about. They probably didn't want to, you know, because it was still a mystery, even up to the time when Paul was talking about it in the New Testament.
Good point. Good point. I like that. And Dale, you want to probably piggyback off that.
Yeah, there may even have been a sense of the 10 tribes and the 2 tribes getting back together and having some uniting of Israel to go be the great and majestic nation they were always thought they would be.
Yeah.
And so they might have misunderstood nations to mean them, not necessarily Gentiles. But there might have been some intrigue in this, in that being able to go accomplish the great nation that they've always been waiting for.
Yeah, and that, you know, nation is always going to be a big buzzword for them. House of the Lord as well. House of the Lord is always going to be a buzzword for the original audience who would have received this message. Good point, Dale. Good point. I like a couple details here that I like. That he may teach us concerning his ways and that we may walk in his paths. I like that. The motivation here is that the people, the nations, want to come and learn. That's, I don't know, to me, that's kind of a unique idea there, because what's most often, how do churches present themselves today? I just mean broader Christendom, Christianity in general. How do churches present themselves today? Do you hear a lot of churches touting their education programs? No, it's always our worship is heartfelt, it's a place for families, it's coffee and donuts, it's social events, it's what can we do for you. It's appealing to people, selling, it's consumerism, you know, a free t-shirt for everybody, for every visitor. I mean, it's consumerism at its core. And of course, I can't stand as their judge. I'm not the judge of the world. I don't get to decide who. And yet, what is missing in all of that is come and learn about God. That's really what it is. It's learn about God and learn how to live by his ways. Teach us your ways, God, so that we can walk in them. That's what they want. Mitch had a comment up
just
here.
Just to back up one phrase.
Yeah, one phrase in verse 3.
Yeah, when he talks about, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. When you get over in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 15, He talks about the house of God being the church.
Yeah.
Which is the pillar and the ground of the truth.
Okay, yeah.
So there's certainly some implications there that based on that phrase and then how it's identified in the New Testament, that he's literally talking about the church.
Yeah, that's a good point. I like that connection you've drawn there. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 15 is where he was talking about, if you didn't hear him, that it's described as the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth. And you saw that. You know, I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but did you see that in Acts chapter 2? Did the nations stream to the mountain of the house of the Lord in Acts chapter 2? They even point out early on in the chapter when they're hearing them speaking in tongues, they even point out how many different kinds of people are there. Now, they were perhaps proselytes, Jewish proselytes, or people who were Jews who happened to live in different parts of the world, but you can see that there was a very, very diverse crowd of religious people there listening to the sermon on the day of Pentecost. Were there Gentiles interested in the gospel almost from the very beginning? Jesus, I say this jokingly, you know, Jesus practically had to beat Gentiles off with a stick. They were so curious. They wanted to know. Boy, that Samaritan woman at the well, boy, did she have some zeal. She was a woman who was incredibly curious about this. She wanted to know too. And when she learned things about Jesus, she went back to her town there and she told everybody about it. And she said, it's not because of the miracle anymore, it's because of the witness. It's because of the testimony and the truth that was preached now that we are believing. Jesus had to beat the Gentiles off of a stick, so to speak, because they were so excited. Every time he left Galilee, when he crossed the Galilean Sea, for example, went to Decapolis, which would be a primarily Gentile area, were they just eating it up? In Decapolis? Man, they loved it. They loved Jesus. When Paul went out to the Gentiles, did Paul have a hard time drumming up interest amongst Gentiles in the gospel? No. More often than not, he had to wash his hands of the Jews in a community and say, I'm done, guys. I cannot do this anymore in these synagogues. I'm just going to preach to Gentiles because they actually want to know. So I'm glad you pointed that out, Mitch, that the church is the mountain of the house of the Lord, in a sense. You can interpret it that way, and the nations are streaming to the church. As we are the body of Christ, we represent Him, we preach His truth and preach His gospel, they stream to the truth. They want to know it. They're excited about it. Very stimulating. Good comment. I like that. Anyway, let's just wrap this up here with this idea of that He may teach us concerning His ways. I just think it's sad to see the state of religion in America today because so many churches simply want to cater to the desires and requests of potential converts just to win them over, just to have a larger membership or contribute more money, when really true Christianity is about learning. Now, it's about charity. It's about experiencing. It can be about feelings and emotions as well. But I think the core of what the gospel is all about is we need to teach the way of God. Teach people. That's why we offer Bible studies, and we call them Bible studies. When I want to sit down with somebody, I call them and say, hey, you want to have a Bible study this week? Hey, you want to sit down and study the Bible this week? And I'm always amazed at the people who will sit down in a Bible study and go, I didn't think we'd actually study the Bible. I'm so shocked. We're studying the Bible. Now, maybe we don't keep everybody. Maybe we sit down for a Bible study and our success rate might not be 100%. Maybe people who come here and visit us for a Sunday or a couple Sundays or come for a Bible class, they might not stay. But I will tell you this. Almost everybody who I talk to who comes as a visitor to Monte Vista or back in Abilene or where I grew up in Beaverton, if you are a church that is teaching truth, you're not going to keep everybody. And I get that. But almost everybody who visits a truth-teaching church will walk away impressed with the teaching. They might not agree with it. They might not believe it. They might not be convicted by it. But I have heard so many people say, wow, you know, Monte Vista, the way you guys teach the Bible, the way you promote the Bible, the way your Bible class curriculum, it's really impressive. You guys teach the Word. I'm like, thank you. That's kind of the Isaiah chapter 2 goal, isn't it? Now, I'm not puffing us up or puffing myself up or patting myself on the back. I'm just trying to say we need to keep our focus on the right place. It's not about appealing to the emotions, the feelings, or the physical appetite. It has to be, are we teaching people the way of truth so that they can, as the text says, so that they can learn how to walk in His paths? That's the key.
Most of the world thinks the church is about gaining money.
Yeah.
That we're just another group wanting money.
And the many bad examples that exist out there give Christianity and religion in general and organized religion. I hate that term, by the way. I don't believe in organized religion. So you just believe in chaotic religion? You know, I was wondering about that. But it does give it a bad name. And it's true. There are a lot of bad examples out there. The Benny Hinn's of the world.
Even the Roman Catholic Church.
Even very, very large and noteworthy and highly honored religious organizations. You know, we can't be their judge because we don't know their motives. But it's hard not to look at some of the largest religions in the world and go, you know, you live in a gilded palace, you know. I'm sorry, you wear a $2,000 hat. And you live in a gilded palace, it's hard not to think, like, what are you in this for? And what are you really promoting? And what are you really teaching? Let's look at the end of verse 3. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. I think that this is a prophecy that is directly and very pointedly fulfilled in the time of Jesus Christ and his apostles. In Luke chapter 24, the end of Luke 24, verses 46 and 47, thus it is written that the Christ should suffer and rise again from the dead, and that repentance for forgiveness of sins should be proclaimed in his name to all the nations, beginning with Jerusalem. Acts chapter 1 and verse 12, Jesus makes it very clear. You're going to start in Jerusalem and work your way out from there. And then there's the dispersion. I note in the notes here in Acts 8 verse 1. Acts chapter 8, when Saul persecutes the church. That's really the first really widespread dispersion of Christians. And I love it, by the way. Paul tries to put the fire out, but all he does is kick hot embers all over the place and start a bunch of other hot fires everywhere. You can't stomp Christianity out. 2,000 years of history have shown you can't stomp Christianity out. It doesn't work. You kick it, and all you're doing is just spreading embers everywhere. And that's what happened. It started in Jerusalem, 3,000 people baptized on the day of Pentecost, growing to about 5,000. Perhaps even, by Acts chapter 8, perhaps even as much as 10,000 people. And then Saul shows up, and all those Christians, or at least a great majority of them, they don't lose their faith. What do? They disperse. So they go around to all these other cities teaching their faith to other people. It started in Jerusalem, worked its way out, and I believe Acts chapter 2, verse 3 is precisely and fully fulfilled beginning in Jerusalem in Acts chapter 1 and 2. And I love that connection there. And he will judge between the nations. He'll judge between the nations. That's his prerogative, that's his place, that's Psalm 2, some of the other things that we've looked at as well. He holds his righteous scepter, okay? This is a king. He rules. Let's not put it any other way. He is not. Jesus, in his earthly lifetime, in his ministry, might have been a very, very unimportant figure. A dirt poor fellow from, you know, Galilee. The boonies, basically. But let's not put it any other way. Jesus rules. He rules from on high. He rules this world. And he judges between the nations. I think that's part of it. You know, we studied Psalm 2 a few weeks ago. I think that's part of the warning there. You remember in Psalm 2, in one of the last verses of Psalm 2, how he says in verse 10, "Now therefore, O kings, show discernment. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Worship the Lord with reverence. Rejoice with trembling. Pay homage to the Son, lest he become angry and you perish in the way. For his wrath may soon be kindled. How blessed are those who take refuge in him." That's a warning to them. I think there's a connection there. He judges. And that is a big part of what he does. Any comments up to this point? If I've missed anything or need to catch up on anything? Let's talk briefly then about this idea of halfway through verse 4. They'll hammer their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation. Never again will they learn war. Okay, did they learn war after Isaiah 2? Yeah. Was there still war going on during the time of Christ? Yeah. Was there still war going on after Christ? Yeah. Matthew chapter 24, Jesus himself says, "And there will be wars and rumors of wars." So even Jesus admits, that human carnal warfare is just a part of life that it will always go on. So how is Isaiah 2 verse 4 possibly going to be fulfilled in a world that to this day still suffers from human warfare? Are there different ways that you can maybe look at Isaiah 2 verse 4 to see its fulfillment?
He's talking about the peaceful nature of the kingdom, of the church, and not... Because there are people who take this literally, like you said, even today, and I have friends that believe this. You know, well, the nuclear weapons are going to go away, and everyone's going to not do this stuff anymore. And he's not talking about that at all, as you pointed out. I think he's just saying, you know, the kingdom is not of this world. If it was, then my servants would fight. It's just the peaceful nature of the kingdom of the church.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think when he says here that nation will not lift sword up against nation, I don't think he's talking literally about no human nation will ever fight with another human nation. I think what he's saying is people from different nations will coexist peacefully in God's church. In God's kingdom, nations that might otherwise be at war with each other will coexist in God's kingdom. And you see that in the first century, don't you? Did the Jews spend a lot of time with the Gentiles? No. There was a lot of animosity between those two groups. They did not like each other very much. The Jews saw the Gentiles as dirty, uncircumcised heathens, and they washed their hands every time they got Gentile cooties on them. And the Gentiles thought the Jews were just weird. They thought that they were kind of anti-Roman political zealots, insurrectionists. They thought they were strange because of their monotheistic ideas. There was an inherent cultural, social, and religious warfare going on, as well as physical carnal warfare. The Jews had a history with Rome, didn't they? They had a history with Rome, and I don't think the Jews were central Rome's favorite people in the outskirts of their empire. So there was actual physical warfare that occurred, and yet groups that would never otherwise coexist, did they find coexistence together in the church? Yeah, it was hard sometimes. Romans, the book of Galatians, it was hard sometimes, but they were together, and they learned how to be peaceful and coexisting. Yeah, go ahead.
As you look in the Old Testament, the conquest of God's people almost always involved war.
Yeah,
I mean, they were fighting, and they were over... I mean, when they went into Canaan, that wasn't God being peaceful with the world.
Yeah.
I mean, they took over people, and then the wars continued through all the kings, but the focus of New Testament, of the new covenant, was not about fighting anymore.
Yeah.
There were no... I mean, nations are going to fight, but God's focus and his people's focus will not be about war anymore.
Yeah.
It'll be about conquest of people to the kingdom and going up to the house of the Lord.
Yeah.
And it won't be about fighting in wars anymore.
And you will have, and have had for 2,000 years now, these very, very different groups who will come to the mountain of the house of the Lord, and they'll say, you know what? When I'm at the mountain of the house of the Lord, I don't need my sword anymore. I'll put down my sword. And then another person says, that's true. I don't need my spear anymore. I'm at the house of the Lord. I don't need my spear. I'll put my spear down. You'll put your sword down. We'll turn those things into productive things. What do they turn the sword and the spear into? Plowshares and pruning hooks. Catching. Harvesting. What did Jesus say about being fishers of men? Yeah. You'll put your nets down now, Peter, Andrew, James, John, and I'll make you fishers of men now. The fields, yeah, the fields are white for harvest. Yes, that's right. That's right, but very, very few are the reapers, right? We need reapers. They're going to turn their weapons into collecting devices now, harvesting devices. And I think that that's a really cool picture. And again, we can see even in our own lives, people that might not otherwise ever spend time with each other. And I know we're not at war with each other in America, necessarily not at civil war or whatever, but you know, there's people at Monte Vista who, if it wasn't for the church, I might never have met you otherwise. And I'm not saying I'm prejudiced against you. I'm saying that there would not have been any other mechanism, okay, for us to meet and be together. I live in Gilbert, okay? I don't go to Phoenix very often for anything but Monta Vista. Whether it's work during the week or worship on Sunday, I might not meet anybody from Phoenix if it wasn't for this. And there are, I think you can even see more extreme examples of that as well, where people who might even be in conflict, but not just indifferent or ambivalent, but people who might even be in conflict with each other who have come together because of the cross of Christ. I can give you one quick historic example, and then Brian, you've got a comment. I have been reading the biography of a turn-of-the-century preacher named Marshall Keble. Some of the older folks in here are probably familiar with the name Marshall Keble. He was a black preacher who started preaching right around the turn of the century, 1900 or so, when he was a very young man. And he preached all the way into the 1960s. I believe he was like 89 years old or when he passed away. And he was one of the very first people who was able to bridge the gap between black Christians and white Christians in the first half of the 20th century, groups that never would have been around each other, even in the South, which is where he preached most often, was down in the South. He got the Klan to take their hoods off and come to gospel meetings with black Christians. People who would be so at odds with each other in every other part of life, they put the weapons down and they came together for the gospel. And a lot of good was done. That's just one historical example. Brian, go ahead.
I was just going to say the word community sometimes gets a bad rap, especially maybe in the denominational use of it today. But that's exactly what this is describing here. This is a community of people. This is a group of people who are coming together for a common purpose, for a common mission, at a common place, which is the mountain of God. And so that's sort of this... You know, it is a community. It is, and that's the whole purpose for the peace that we see here, is because it's not, we're no longer at odds anymore. We all have something in common. We're all at the same mountain together. And yeah. So, like you say, we can put down our differences and set them aside and use those differences for the cause of Christ. But, you know, it is a
heaven,
community.
In heaven, am I going to be black or white, rich or poor, Republican or Democrat? No. those earthly differences are all going to fade. David had a comment back there.
In Christianity, we're busy worrying about or learning about serving others and loving our enemy, mm-hmm. not learning war.
That's right. Very good comment. And we'll go and bring the class to a close with that being said. What happened was I wanted to throw Isaiah 7, verse 14 in as almost just like a closing statement in this class, but we've hit our hour just about. And in studying for Isaiah, I had decided there's just really a lot more in that prophecy that we need to talk about from Isaiah 7. We need to talk about the backstory of what was Ahaz's situation when he was facing destruction at the hands of the northern tribes of Israel as well as Damascus. The Assyrian specter on the horizon, and just what did Isaiah mean when he mentioned to Ahaz that a son will be born to a virgin, and that's going to be the sign of something good to come? What did he really mean by that? So I think what I'm going to do, I think I'm going to take my notes from that, and I'm just going to put together a sermon, maybe a month or so from now when we've sort of, you know, we've talked about messianic prophecies, and maybe in a month or two when we kind of have taking all of this in and we're ready to talk about it again. I'll probably just do a sermon about it so we can really flesh it out and talk about it, give it its due. So we'll bring class to a close. I believe that next Sunday is our last class from Isaiah chapter 40 and Isaiah 42, which is just tickles me silly because that middle chunk of Isaiah is such a cool, cool part of the book.
Not next Sunday, the 21st.
21st? Yeah. Okay, thank you. What's going on next Sunday? Oh, that's right, deacons meeting. Okay. So, see you in a few minutes.